Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable on this Thursday morning. It is the 8th of April. It's 13 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we are more than a little happy to have you all with us. Let me introduce the group, and I will also remind you that you can be a part of the program. All you have to do is write to us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Hi, Joe. I'm doing well.
Good.
In fact, I'm even doing good.
Good. Well, those are all positive words. That's good. A good way to start the morning. Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics Vera Acarius Kelly is here. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning, Joe and everyone. I'm well as well. The sun is shining. No complaints.
Yeah, this has been a beautiful week weather-wise. Mm. Just perfect temperatures and sunny and lovely. And hopefully you're getting out and enjoying it after a winter. It's been a nice refresh. Speaking of refreshing, we go to publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, everyone. Joe, I'd like you to move the program along quickly today because I have to make an Andrew Giuliani rally later. So make sure we finish on time. Fortunately, Tiger Woods may drive me there, so I'll have a little extra time.
Wow, you got two zingers in. That's good. Wow. Yeah, that's good making. You know, I can't be the only one, but you remember when Giuliani was inaugurated as mayor, and Andrew's the little kid who is his pulling his jacket, and now he's like all grown up and running for governor. Apparently, I don't know. Very weird. So we'll follow that story.
Check out the editorial cartoon in the Daily News today, where it has Andrew Giuliani behind the podium saying on day one, the first thing he's going to do is rename the Tappan Zee Bridge after his father.
Well, we laugh until we cry. Professor and director of sociology honors program in the sociology department at UAlbany. It's a second time being on the program, and we were so thrilled that she joined us the first time. We were delighted to have her back. Angie Chung, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I have my coffee, so I think I'm set for the morning.
Great. You're set.
It's such
you're
a pleasure
ready
to be back.
It's a pleasure to have you back. Thank you very much. A great honor to have you. All right. We have a whole lot of stuff to talk about. We'll get to it. We want you to join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Driving home yesterday, I was listening to President Biden talk about his tax plan and what was going on for the American Jobs Plan, as it is being called. Large companies like Apple and Bristol Myers Squibb have long employed complicated maneuvers to reduce or eliminate their tax bills by shifting income on paper between countries. The strategy has enriched accountants and shareholders while driving down corporate tax receipts for the federal government. President Biden sees ending that practice as central to his $2 trillion infrastructure package, pushing changes to the tax code that his administration says will ensure American companies are contributing tax dollars to help invest in the country's roads, bridges, water pipes, and in other parts of his economic agenda. On Wednesday, the Treasury Department released the details of Mr. Biden's tax plan, which aims to raise as much as $2.5 trillion over 15 years to help finance the infrastructure proposal. That includes bumping the corporate tax to 28% from 21%, imposing a strict new minimum tax on global profits, and cracking down on companies that try to move profits offshore. That from the New York Times. Alan Chartok, we'll begin with you.
The full employment for lobbyists on K Street has begun. This is great news for them. They can come out and they can go to their favorite senators who they give money to one way or the other. I don't mean direct bribes, but they campaign contributions and the rest of it. And they'll say, hey, we can't afford to do this. And believe me, they are getting ready right now to do it. It's a great idea. I think most Americans who don't fall into the highest brackets will applaud it. I think on the other hand, those people who have the gelt, the money, will now turn around and do everything in their power to make sure that they have every penny that they can't spend if they live 25 lifetimes.
Angie, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think there needs to be a change. I remember 20 years ago, you would hear a lot of, if you speak to a lot of the urban planning faculty, you know, this America's infrastructure is in such poor shape. These are bridges and different types of facilities that have a lifespan of 50 years, you know, on average. And yet we haven't fixed them in, you know, centuries. So I think that, you know, certainly from the perspective of making sure that America keeps moving and that we also bring jobs to Americans, you know, this is a win-win. It just seems to me that we're dealing with a lot of class inequality in the United States. So this kind of policy is very badly needed.
And Ira Fussfeld.
Yeah, I think as Angie said, the work that needs to be done is long overdue, and now it's all coming together at the same time, which means it's going to be very expensive. And for those who think that the expense is not worth it, or that the taxing the corporations is not the way to go, fine. How would you do it? First of all, do you start with the premise that the work doesn't need to be done? If you agree that it needs to be done, how would you pay for it? But one way or the other, this is going to have to happen, or else the country is literally going to fall apart. Now, there's plenty of room for compromise here, and Biden has had a history of dealing in the Senate and understands what compromise is, and all he needs to do, he has plenty of room to move if we can get the other side to move, and of course that's a big if. But you know, the bottom line here is that A, needs to be done, and B, the public is on the side of Biden. Much like with the COVID package, the majority of this country wants to see something like this happen, and now's the time it has to be done.
And yet, Ira, not a single vote from the Republicans.
No, that's just shameful.
And you know, with Joe Manchin doing his thing, it gets to be very iffy whether you can mobilize the country to lean so heavily on the Republicans that they will shift. So far, no go. And I think a lot of that has to go to the guy who used to have orange hair, who was sitting on the sidelines.
Oh, he still has orange hair.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, it's still orange.
making sure that they behave, that you know, it doesn't turn in a way that Manchin will be the 51st vote for the Republicans.
And Vera Carius Kelly.
So I would say corporate income tax is incredibly important as one of the, I think it was the third largest source of federal revenue for the government. So without it, you can't really afford an infrastructure plan or any major projects across the country. And everyone on the program already said it's exceptionally important. And we also have to remember that you know, at times of crisis, this country did increase its corporate taxes. And I looked it up earlier, the gross domestic product, the share, the tax percentage of the gross domestic product in this country was at a high right during World War II at 7%. And then it went down to about 1% of GDP in 1984, ticked up a bit. In 2019, it was right around 1% again, which is a very low rate. And we just don't have the money to invest in major infrastructure projects, which is exactly what this country needs, so that we can have projects across the country that addresses fundamental needs such as securing water supplies, electricity access, internet opportunities, fast internet access, and so on. Bridges, roads. I mean, it's if you travel across this country again, you will see the state of affairs, I think.
So Vera, how can the Republicans vote against that?
Well, it's because they simply count on the fact that most people are so trained in to say corporate taxes are bad, because then corporations will simply not invest domestically and then not hire, which is it has turned out to be not accurate. What corporations have done is transported some of their operations offshore. We know that they go to places like, you know, the Bahamas or Bermuda or the Cayman Islands, where there are zero tax brackets. You know, this has been a common practice, and you can convince the American public that taxes are bad because it means corporations are not investing domestically and not hiring. And this is something that a lot of people don't like to think through. They're just trained in to believe that this is that taxes are a problem for the American worker.
But Alan, let me ask you this question, because I know you've explained this to me a billion times over the years, and I'm going to ask you again, because I either don't remember or I don't understand it. But if you have the Republicans not supporting this, and yet the polls show that they are in support of the president, and then and even a third of Republicans who responded are in support of this measure, why then can they not get the vote or votes and have it be more bipartisan when the people are behind it? I understand if it's a party thing, I got it. But if not, I scratch my head on that.
It comes down to Trump. It really does. I mean, you know, he's sitting on the sidelines. He says anybody gets out of line, they're going to have a primary opponent. We're not going to give anything to the Democrats now in which they can have bragging rights when I run against them in the next time. Now, will he? We don't know. But is he preparing to? Absolutely. You know, he said it in the past and he did it. He'll do it. He promised he would do it. He suggested he would do it. He did it. And I believe he's going to do it again. And so that's the easy answer is they know what's right, these people, and they know what their voters want. But they're not going to step out of line and risk the wrath of Trump.
I thought Biden was very realistic on this measure. There was a question that came from NBC following his address, and they said, "Well, how are you going to, if you don't get any Republican votes for this, how are you fulfilling your campaign promise of being bipartisan and working with the Republicans?" And he said, "Well, we're being bipartisan. We're bringing them in the room. We're having them talk. And yet, if they're not going to budge at all, as they did on the first in the relief package, there's not much we can do." And then I thought this was a good point. So what are you going to, if just because they don't play along, you're going to do nothing, even though you have the votes to pass it? I guess there's really no other, to me, there's really no other way to look at it other than that, right?
Well, the only question is, who will break ranks in the Republic among the Republicans?
And will anybody break ranks?
And will anybody? Yeah. So far, we've seen a no. Susan Collins, which we all used to mumble about and say, oh, well, Collins will do something, or, you know, some of the others, a couple of the others. Nobody is doing a thing. They are not breaking ranks for good reason, and they think, and that's to preserve their behinds.
Ira?
Well, a couple of things. One is let's not forget that the corporate tax rate was dropped during the Trump administration. So restoring it to closer to what it was is not as dramatic a change as it might seem otherwise. Secondly, and Vera alluded to this, and I'm not sure how much it works on the federal level, but I was involved quite a bit years ago with economic development issues in the Hudson Valley. And I was always surprised to learn that when the Hudson Valley, taking as a whole, was competing to get business or industry to move into our region, that we were not just competing with the South or the far West, but we were competing with countries from around the world, and that tax incentives were necessary to lure businesses or industries to your area. That's a fact of life. I'm not defending it. I'm just saying that's the way business works. And so to the extent that corporations on the federal level have benefited from that kind of tax, I'll use the word generosity, but I'm not sure that's entirely accurate. There's nothing wrong with it, except that it's now hurting us, and we need to change the way the direction of this country has gone. And I certainly believe starting with the tax rate and raising it to back where it was is a good start. I don't. Do you remember anyone what the high number was before it was lowered to 21%? Was it over 30?
Oh, 28. It was just slightly above 28%.
I'm more than a little impressed that you looked that up before the show.
28 from 21. What was it before it was 21? I don't remember.
Yeah. Well, we can check during the break. All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have letters, and we welcome yours. We have a great panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Angie Chung is here, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Ira Fussfeld. We will continue our conversation and do all of that after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Alan Chartok, Angie Chung, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Ira Fussfeld with us this morning. We have some letters, so we'll go there. Mike writes, the Republicans know the economic policies endorsed by the Democrats are correct and will work. That is why they obstruct. They know these policies will succeed. They must obstruct to prevent the Democrats from succeeding. Well, there is some truth to that, given the knee-jerk reaction of Mitch McConnell in the past, right, Alan, of saying our job is to make Obama one-term president, and even in the first package of the Biden administration, of saying we have to dig in our heels and make sure none of this passes.
Well, that's right. No question in my mind that the Republicans know that if he gets this stuff done, he's going to be reelected, or somebody in his shadow will be reelected. In Democratic shadow, of course. They are going to put... Have you ever seen McConnell's face as stressed as it is now?
More muscles than I thought it did.
It's unbelievable. I mean, he really is. He's...
But where are the patriots? Where are the Republicans who understand that spending an amount of money for much-needed infrastructure work is necessary for the health and the well-being of this country, both internally and how we appear around the world? Where are those people? They apparently no longer exist in Washington.
Well, Ira, when you do the polling, it's amazing how many Republicans are for this plan.
Right.
Yes.
So that you make a very good point. There is a disconnect between the people who vote for these foolish people and those who represent them. They just don't want to lose their office. It's really that simple.
Angie?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at some of the numbers here, I was just looking this up before, but the American Society of Civil Engineers gives the U.S. infrastructure a D+ rating. Now, if we're talking about trying to have America go ahead, this seems just like something you would focus on immediately. And I think, you know, I agree with Alan, you know, certainly Trump, the Trump era facilitated a lot of these kind of stonewalling tactics. But this began even before then. You know, we know during the Obama administration that every single kind of move he tried to make was basically shot down so that he had a lot of difficulty accomplishing anything. So I almost wonder if, you know, President Biden should try to, you know, try a more aggressive move or something. This is, it just stuns me that there's so much popularity. And I do wonder to what extent, you know, certainly lobbying and the importance of money and politics overrides a lot of public opinion in these types of cases.
Vera?
Well, I completely agree with Angie. I think she points to some very disturbing trends in this country. And I wonder if there's also this thought process that Americans as voters just don't pay attention, don't like complicated, complex, or multidimensional arguments. You know, I think it's an exclusion of the needs and positions and ideas that voters actually could bring or do bring to the table. And it sort of reminds me of this elite group, especially among the Republicans, who are thinking through notions and concepts and what they want to achieve politically, but it's very short term and inconsiderate of general voters' interests, because they're simply counting on the fact that people will not step up in the next election, they will be confused or forget about certain issues.
Then how much of that is on the Democrats? Because I certainly understand the average voter not understanding or want to understand a corporate tax and a flat corporate tax and all of that. But if you simple it, if you make it simple and bring it down to infrastructure and bridges and say to the average voter, you know, you don't have to, you voter living in Gilderland, don't have to drive through the state of Maine to get to the store if we have, if we can fix the roads and bridges that we have in the state. Like, we make that
case.
Yeah,
I mean, I think part of it is knowing how to, I agree with Vera, like, you have to package it in simple terms. And if there's anything that Trump was able to do, and that was to package things in very simple terms, right? Simply say, look at our rating, right? On infrastructure, we want America to, you know, be ahead, and we are a completely developed nation, and yet we have this, you know, our bridges, our schools, you know, everything we value falling apart, and you can see it physically, like anyone who looks around their neighborhoods, right? You could see that it's falling apart. So I think part of it is being able to simplify that message and really package it in a way that people can, you know, rally around it.
I keep trying to make the point that anybody who doesn't understand it should just drive over to Great Barrington and try to cross a bridge, because three bridges are out, and I'm waiting for this program.
And they're out because they need fixing, right? I mean, that's...
They're out because they need fixing, yeah. And there wasn't the money to fix them, and they're waiting on the federal government to do it, and I'm not letting our selectmen off the hook here in Great Barrington, because they ought to be pushing a lot harder than I think they are, although who knows. But if what's going on in this little town is going on everywhere else, you know, it's bad.
Yeah.
Well,
Democrats have had a lot of trouble with their messaging for at least a couple of decades. Maybe my memory is failing me, but when Carville and Begala were running the Clinton campaign, they described issues for Clinton in ways that resonated with the public. I think we've talked about it on this program, you know, using phrases like defunding the police or global warming as opposed to climate change. They don't not only not resonate, but they scare people, it's hard to understand why the Democrats don't better message, but it's important. Now, that said, they could stand on their heads and say it easiest way as possible. If those stories are not getting through to Republicans, and by that I mean they're not getting through to them because on Fox News or on the right-wing social media or radio platforms, they're not hearing the story the same way that the rest of us are hearing it. You know, it's no wonder that the hard right is where it's at, because they're often not being told the truth. And as I say, you can message it any way you want. If you're a Democrat, they're not going to. They're not only not going to hear it, they're not going to listen to it. They're not going to hear it.
So here's a very specific question from Peter, who says, it seems to me that roads are built to technical specifications that allow large vehicles carrying freight and product across the country. Why has Biden not presented the argument that those who use the roads for their commerce need to pay upkeep on that commercial trade? How much stress does a 26,000-pound, 24-foot truck put on the road compared to an SUV? How about a fully loaded 50-foot trailer? Who really needs to pay taxes for infrastructure here? As I said, a very specific question. Anyone want to take a crack at it?
Ira. Maybe I can comment on this for a second, because I think it makes sense to charge those who have, you know, drivers who work for large corporations. But we also know that many drivers are purchasing their own trucks.
Right.
And they form an LLC, and if they are charged the same rate as big companies that have their own fleet and pay their drivers a certain, you know, amount, that is a more complicated issue in this country.
When you say complicated, what do you mean? I mean, the letter writer was quite specific, saying,
if you are an indebted driver who was forced to buy his own truck and owes $200,000 on purchasing a truck to run his own LLC. Mm-hmm. That is what makes it almost impossible.
to say, yes, oh, by the way, then you also have to pay these taxes.
Yes.
Right. So Nancy writes, the corporate tax rate before the 2017 cut was 35%, which loopholes reduced.
They really cut it way down.
Sometimes to 0%. Tax revenues do not fund federal spending. The highest marginal income tax rate during Eisenhower's presidency was over 90%. The economy was booming. There was no mass exodus. So that from Nancy. We thank her for that. We go to Vesta, who says Republicans will not cooperate with Biden just as they wouldn't cooperate with Obama. They won't vote for any Democratic bill, yet they signaled they would have gone along with infrastructure and $2,000 COVID relief when Trump was president. They have become a party of opposing Democrats, culture wars, health care, common sense, gun laws that are overwhelmingly popular with the American public. The only way to pass anything is with reconciliation or alter and eliminate slash eliminate filibuster, and Manchin is signaling he won't go along with it.
The Manchin problem is huge. It really is, with a 50-50 split. So this guy really has, the entire system at his knees. I don't think there's any question that he is like so many Republicans who feel that they can't alienate the president. And in his case, he's in a Republican state. And even if it's for the good of mankind and probably for the good of the Democrats, let's face it, if they lose Manchin, they're done. Right now, that's 50-50. Well, when an election happens and you lose a guy like that, it could be critical. So they've got to be standing on their toes, too.
Let's see. We have to go to a break, but I want to get a couple more letters in here before we do. Julia says corporations depend on U.S. infrastructure for their operations and must pay for its maintenance. Joel says, why will no Republican vote for the Biden plan? Simple, because it's the Biden plan. If this were the $2 trillion Trump plan, every Republican would vote for it.
Well, how come there wasn't a $2 trillion Trump plan?
Yeah, there was.
That's the interesting question. He kept talking about infrastructure repair, but he didn't do it. He kept talking about health care, but he didn't do it.
Ned writes, just take a lot of pictures showing decay of structures and publish them. People won't respond to surveys or ratings. Pictures will do it. We'll pause there. We'll take a break. And when we return, we'll add another letter or two. Plus, we'll go to new topics as well. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org on this Thursday morning edition of the Roundtable. We will be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. And we have letters here. Let's get to them. Barbara writes, in response to the question about making trucks pay for their road use, they do. Trucks pay taxes, fees on every mile driven on. Somebody's TV's on.
It's not mine.
Okay. Well, I wasn't accusing you, Alan. I wasn't blaming you. I was just asking. I was asking the crowd at large. All right. Well, there's a TV on, so if we or something, there's some other broadcast medium going on. Let's see. We go to Susan, who writes, Manchin is worried about losing to a Republican. Perhaps it is time for Schumer to tell him they plan a primary with a Democrat who will work with them. Perhaps it is time for Biden to tell him that he is appointing Stacey Abrams to handle the election in West Virginia.
I get the frustration, but come on. You know, it's a Republican state. Manchin is walking a tightrope. He's been able to be very successful in former jobs and now as a senator. I get it. I understand where he is. If you throw him out, the chances of getting another Democratic senator are not good.
You think the Manchin is holding out to get more of that money? More money will go into West Virginia than perhaps ordinarily would have?
Possible, Ira, but you never know. I mean, you just don't know what his motives are. I think his motives are quite clear, to tell you the truth, and that is that he wants to keep getting reelected. He wants to be popular. It's a Republican state, and he'll do anything he can to make sure that he doesn't tick off his voters.
The support there, though, and I understand the ticking off your voters, but he's still an incumbent. I mean, the last time he ran, he won with 61% of the vote. The time before that, he won with almost 58% of the vote.
So how come you think he won with 58% or 61%? Because he has acted in this way as a broker between the majority Republican voters in. I mean, everybody's mad at him. There's no question. I'm not happy with him. Nevertheless, that's the way he thinks he gets reelected. Yeah.
Let's see. Emma says, I think that the wisest thing that Biden and Democrats can do is repeat these ideas. We are speaking ideas and votes from we are seeking ideas and votes from Republican voters who understand how necessary and helpful it is to them to have improved improved internet access, safer and cleaner drinking water and sewage disposal, an improved electrical grid, roads, bridges, and a modern public transportation system. These improvements create local jobs that cannot be moved to other countries. Our bill is representing the needs of the majority of the U.S. public and is therefore bipartisan. The polls will show at least a few Republican senators could vote for these bills because they are either not running in the next election and others represent purple states and they could lose their elections if they do not listen to intelligent Republican voters. Let's see. This from Barbara. In response to the question about making trucks pay for the road use, they do. Oh, did I get? I'm not sure I got all the way through this one. Trucks pay taxes, fees on every mile driven on, as I remember from many years of driving one and noting the state miles, roads in each state. They also pay fuel taxes and pay for permits to be able to bring the truck into states. And yes, it is true that they outweigh cars, but how many pallets of lettuce can you carry in your SUV? Well, you make an excellent point. Yes. There is a lettuce capacity there, isn't there? We got this from Mike. Hey, don't fall out of your chair laughing at this, but the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee is telling donors this. If you uncheck the recurring donation box and the solicitation letter from Donald Trump, they will be listed as defectors to the radical left. Last election, I made several donations to a Democratic congressional candidate of the choices. The very first one was, is this a one-time gift? I always check, yes. So this, of course, is in reference to the Trump policy, apparently, where if you gave money, you were, there's an asterisk on this word I'm about to use, but they secretly had you basically, once they had your information, they had you signed up, so then it became a recurring gift. So if you gave them $50, then that would recur monthly, which is why they were bringing so much money in before a lot of people caught on to the fact that the money was coming out and they meant it as a one-time gift and not as a recurring gift. Did I get that right, panel? Does that make sense?
Remember the game that they used to play in Times Square where you would have the three shells and you move the ball around
three
and
card
you had
Monty.
To guess which one?
Yeah.
That's what's going on there.
Daisy says, I don't think Manchin is worried about re-election. He has indicated he is not running again in 2024. Is that true? I'm not disputing Daisy. I just didn't know that was true. Huh. I think he is holding out for money for West Virginia. That from Daisy. And Jen says, both the Secretary of Energy and the Secretary of Transportation were on the Sunday morning shows making the point. One of your panelists suggested about how Biden should talk about corporations that use the infrastructure paying taxes to pay for it, not only with regards to highways, but also ports, airports, bridges, and other infrastructure. Angie?
Yeah, I mean, the more I think about it, I did mention earlier, part of it has to do with, the message that we bring, but, no matter what we say, I do feel like there, all these issues are intertwined with necessary reforms you need to make in the political system. And, continuing kind of these grassroots efforts, that Stacey Abrams and others did to get out the vote and make people aware that, there's a disconnect between what the public wants, including Republicans, and what public officials are voting on, right? So, everything's intertwined, and I think that this is a perfect example and an issue that people can relate to. And so I think we just need to get that message across. It's just, no matter what we do and no matter how much we shout, it's not going to do anything to change the votes, right?
And Vera,
go ahead, Vera, and then Ira, go ahead.
I would also say the main message has to remain consensus building, a public-private partnership for infrastructure. I think it's so delayed and so expensive that you can't do anything but that. And I think Biden's language has to just focus on that and, you know, negotiate with private partners. But it is for the entire country, and it matters for the future of lots of corporations in terms of access to top-notch facilities, including ports and airports. And so it really does matter to push forward this infrastructure bill. And the language of consensus building might just get us in that direction.
Ira?
Well, you know, I talked a little bit about this last week. I know Alan disagreed with me about it, and that was the size of this infrastructure plan and it being called an infrastructure plan, although there are pieces of it that I think most people would not consider infrastructure. You know, if you ask five people what is infrastructure, it's bridges, it's tunnels, it's airports, those kinds of things, all of which needs work and all of which is expensive. They've added on other projects that are, in my view, equally as important and equally as necessary, but that would not necessarily be called infrastructure. And I think that that is something that the opponents or those who want to be opponents of this plan can latch onto by saying, look, they're trying to sneak this stuff by and putting in doubt the veracity of the entire plan. Now, I would agree with you if you said to me, let's go for it, let's make it big, let's roll it all in one and let's get it through. As opposed to breaking it into two pieces, meaning you have to have the fight twice. But I do think that the notion of infrastructure being something other than the bricks and mortar make people wary about how much of this being just simply a pork barrel project.
Now, Ira, you may be right. You may be right, and but how many chances are you going to do? You have the COVID relief package for all those trillions. Then you have this. Are you going to go back again? Now, he has indicated that he wants to negotiate. He said, I'm willing to negotiate. So he puts this big thing through that he wants, and he will clearly not get all of it. But I think that was the strategy. I may be wrong.
Yeah, I that's right. I understand the distinction, and you well may be right, and that's in fact what Biden has done. But I'm just suggesting when they write the great history of this episode, they may think that this was done mistakenly.
We just have about a minute before we go to break. Just want to take a another letter or two. What to do about Joe Manchin? Manchin is worried about losing to a Republican. Perhaps it's time for Schumer to tell him that they plan a primary with a Democrat who will work with them. Perhaps it's time for Biden to tell him that he is appointing Stacey Abrams. Another on the Stacey Abrams question. Good morning, panel. In response to the question about making trucks pay for their roads, they do. Trucks pay taxes and fees for every mile driven. And on bipartisanship, I think the wisest thing that Biden and Democrats can do is repeat the ideas that it is helpful to all of us, not just to them. Well, don't they always try? Isn't that what, I mean, yeah, well, is that the idea of bipartisanship?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And by the way, Trump said the same thing.
Yeah. You always try, right? All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have many more items to discuss, which we will do. Alan Chartok, Angie Chung, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Ira Fussfeld on the program this morning. We will continue. First, we have a break, then news with Ray Graff, then we will be back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. Just checking in my head. Yes, it is Thursday. Let's go to some new topics here. just taking stock.
I get it, Joe. Believe me, I get it.
All right. I found this to be a very interesting story, and I want to have you all chime in on it. The Washington Post are reporting that Republicans are leveraging attention on anti-Asian hate incidents in a bid to overturn affirmative action. Amid increased public attention on anti-Asian hate incidents, some Republicans and conservative-leaning advocacy groups are seeking to leverage the debate to bolster their longstanding efforts to overturn affirmative action policies at elite universities and high schools. GOP lawmakers have railed against the admissions criteria used by Ivy League schools, saying they discriminate discriminate against Asian American students. Influential pundits, including podcast host Ben Shapiro, have made similar arguments on social media, suggesting that Democrats and liberal groups have been duplicitous in their advocacy. And on Tuesday, a new coalition of Asian American groups based mostly on the West Coast called in the Justice Department to reinstate a Trump administration lawsuit, which the Biden administration dropped in February, that had accused Yale University of discriminating against white and Asian American students in its admissions. Angie, let me go to you first on this, of what you make of it.
Sure. I don't see what the link is there between these hate crimes and Ivy League college admissions. But one thing I want to point out is that, people have this misunderstanding of what affirmative action is. Like, in their minds, there's this image of, let's say, a box of files, each designated, divided by race. And for the Asian American box of files, there's a a higher criteria, some kind of higher academic criteria, and for the African American, it's the lower one, and so on and so forth. And this is just so far from what affirmative action is. I've sat in on a lot of these admissions, admissions discussions, and I myself actually do alumni interviews for Yale University, one of the case lawsuits that were brought against regarding anti-Asian, supposedly, affirmative action programs. And, what's going on here is that, there are so many qualified candidates. When I've interviewed so many what we call strong solids, like students that are, extremely, they do everything. They have the AP and honors. They are captain of this, editor of that. They've, even innovated things at Google. It's really extraordinary how strong a lot of these candidates are. And so what the Ivy League Admissions Committee, their task is to figure out how do we pull out who will contribute to, the campus diversity. Like, how do we bring about people who will bring in different perspectives and ideas? And so they don't look at race. They don't just say, oh, this person's Asian American, this person's black, and this is how we're going to divide. What they do is they bring together a holistic formula that looks at all aspects of their experiences as captured in their personal statements and the alumni interviews. And they ask themselves, can they bring something new to this campus, right? This isn't, I just think it's just, the tactic of Edward Blum, who's, by the way, often mobilized against minority rights and immigrant political participation. It's just a tactic to, again, use a simple message to make people think that racism exists against Asian in these admissions processes. So I think, that's very problematic.
Linda Yang, director of Washington Asians for Equality, a group formed in 2018 to oppose affirmative action measures in Washington state, said that she hopes that President Biden, quote, has the courage to officially acknowledge that anti-Asian racism existed before COVID-19 and direct the Justice Department to reinstate the Yale case, which, again, they dropped, accusing Yale University of bias against Asian and white applicants. Is there a sense that this does deal more with the white applicants than it does with the Asian applicants?
Go ahead, Angie.
Angie, and then Barry.
No, I thought I wasn't sure if he was talking to me.
I was. So that's okay. Go ahead, Angie.
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Okay. Without a doubt. I mean, if you look at, different aspects they can, target, to me it seems like they would go after, legacies or athletics, things like that, if they were really that concerned. And if they really think that race matters, if you actually look at Harvard just came out with some statistics on the class of 2025, and they found that Asian Americans were actually had increased to 27.2% of those admitted. Last year, for the class of 2024, is 24.5. And if you go way back in 1980, it was only 3%, right? So if anything, Asian Americans have benefited from affirmative action. So this is really just not accurate, what this kind of this perception that affirmative action has harmed Asian Americans. So I do think this is about other applicants. And, even if you go to UCs, right, the UC has actually, by banning these types of race-conscious admissions, they've actually not helped Asian Americans significantly, with some exceptions. But, that's something that needs to be discussed.
Vera.
Yeah, I was about to talk about very similar issues in terms of admissions classes. A lot of colleges are crafting their class, and they prefer to have a certain number of so-called blue chip students, which are applicants related to sons and daughters of alums or celebrities or others with connections or full pays, who have a certain, advantage. And those tend to be white. And in the California case, we actually know, even though California has had this, we know that California has had this 24-year ban on affirmative action. And what we see now is that it has incredibly negatively affected Latino and Black students in particular, especially Latinos, vastly outnumber other applicants, but they are among the lowest numbers of students making it to college. So I think it's just so convenient for this argument to emerge and essentialize Asian Americans as one group, as if they were one group of people rather than lots and lots of individuals coming from different paths of life and having experienced various challenges along the way. So just like Angie, I find a lot of these arguments deeply suspicious and unjustified if you look at the facts over time.
Professor Shartok, what say you?
Well, I can tell you, I hear arguments on both sides of this, but what I can tell you as a former professor, one doesn't always get to be former. I loved having diversity in my classroom. It was great. And people spoke up and they spoke their mind. So anything that leads to diversity is good as far as I'm concerned. And I think colleges and universities have a right to do that.
Ira.
Yeah, I agree with all of you. And I just wonder how a presumably serious and learned study that would suggest that Asian Americans are suffering, and specifically at Yale, how they can make that case when Yale can turn around and say, wait a minute, 26% of the school's incoming class each year are Asian Americans, up 14% from 20 years ago. So the basis of the argument is specious as far as I'm concerned. And as Alan points out, and maybe the others as well, diversity on a college campus is just another part of the academy that makes people from kids to grown-ups. You get to interact with people who you hadn't been exposed to perhaps over your formative years. College, as I think all of the learned people on this panel, and I don't include me in that number, but college is a lot more than what goes on in the lecture hall, and it's, in my view, a lot more about what goes on in the dormitories and at the dining room and in the library where you get to interact with people. So I just wonder what the real motivation is behind people who suggest what they're suggesting here regarding Asian Americans.
And Angie, I just want to touch on that. Go ahead.
Oh no, I just want to point out too. I think there's a misperception that Asian Americans are opposed to affirmative action. If you look at, there's a lot of data coming out right now. Dr. Jennifer Lee, Janelle Wong, and Karthik Ramakrishnan, and also Dr. Chin and Dr. Poon. They've all shown that Asian Americans, 70% right now, support affirmative actions. And part of that was because a lot of nonprofits and researchers, did the work and showed some of the myths that have been raised about affirmative action. And so it's actually increased. Now, the interesting thing I found out was that the one exception, if you look across nationalities, are the Chinese. And so that kind of puzzled me for a bit because they are kind of 50-50, right, that you have a balance of people who support it and those who don't. So Dr. Poon had done some research, and she found out that part of it has to – most of those people who oppose it are, number one, highly educated immigrants from China, from the STEM field. So a lot of them are buying into this myth, what we call the model minority, right, that – the numbers should basically dictate what, college admissions, and they feel like they've been blocked out despite their success in the field. And they've kind of promoted this through WeChat. And so they found that WeChat is kind of the base. It's the social media that a lot of Chinese populations use, has been the platform for kind of promoting this anti-minority rights movement among Chinese, just like Facebook and other social media was, you know, very important in promoting, you know, Trumpism for a while, right? So it's kind of interesting, but they're a minority, right? But they have such a loud platform to, you know, promote these types of ideas, right, and the myths, right?
The question I was also going to ask you, Angie, is how much back to the sort of the premise of this article, which is that this argument reemerges in this time when there is great concern over Asian American hate towards Asian Americans and hate crimes. How much does something like this and this tactic, if you will, muddy the waters on that and water it and perhaps water it down in some way?
Right. I mean, if anything, I would think that given that, you know, the root of anti-Asian hatred has a lot to do with people's unwillingness to be open to diversity, right? That they do not want to see faces that are not, you know, representative of 1930s America, right? That they imagine a very homogeneous society. And so if anything, I would think that those who are trying to fight anti-Asian hatred want to promote diversity in all its forms, right? Whether it's race or class or, you know, nativity, like all those things are very important to educating our next generation of Americans. We don't want to go backwards. We don't want to be in a state where people have never interacted with minorities and don't know what to do once they go out into the real world, right? Will they be prepared? You know, we're in a global economy where we have to be able to learn to understand other countries and other cultures. And so I think, if anything, anyone who supports fighting anti-Asian violence should want to promote diversity.
Anybody else on that?
Well, you know, it may be a little off topic. I don't think so. As you all remember, I used to interview Mario Cuomo a lot. And, you know, one day I was talking to him about this very subject. And he said to me, so what's the greatest number of students at Stuyvesant High School in New York and Bronx Science? These are the two specialized high schools. And I said, in other words, religion. What religion or what ethnic group? And I said, clearly Jewish, isn't it, Governor? He said, not for 20 years. He said, Asian Americans are the big population, the biggest population subgroup in the high school. So it really made me sit up and take notice that there is an ethic. There's an ethnic ethic about learning and pushing yourself forward. And do we really want to get into the position where we deny that this is the other side of the story? Do we ever want to get into the position where we deny people the right to work hard and get into a place? That is what is going to get an awful lot of people thinking about all this.
All right. We have about 10 minutes. Let's go to another subject. And I say we have 10 minutes. I mean before our bottom of the hour break. So we'll try to get in all. We got all kinds of good stuff today to talk about. So I want to talk about the Derek Chauvin trial. We have been discussing it since it began last week, and it continued yesterday with former officer's defense team arguing that George Floyd saying, "I can't breathe," while police attempted to load him into the squad car, was a form of resisting arrest. Later in the day, Chauvin attorney Eric Nelson played indiscernible body cam audio and claimed Wednesday that Floyd said, "I ate too many drugs." Los Angeles Police Sergeant Jody Steiger, a paid witness for the state, said he could not make out what Floyd said, while James Rayerson, a special agent with the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, said the clip sounded more like, "I ain't do no drugs." Steiger's testimony came as prosecutors began to shift from police testimony into the larger investigation of Floyd's death. The county medical examiner is expected to testify later this week. This does bring up, of course, the issue of a larger issue in the media which the Washington Post is reporting about today, about how right-wing media is continuing to smear George Floyd with racist and a no-angel narrative. The shorthand being used here is that they're calling it the George Floyd trial. George Floyd is not on trial. The Minneapolis police officer, Derek Chauvin, is. He was the man who knelt on George Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes. But some in right-wing media continue to do their utmost to make the tragedy about Floyd's drug use and troubled life in what seems like an attempt to absolve Chauvin long before the jury reaches a verdict, in effect putting Floyd on trial. So, putting those stories together, Alan.
You know, it is so clear that that a murder was done here, and that that the American people are being sitting in front of their televisions. I know I am, and transfixed with the idea that somehow in this country, where diversity is so important, that this guy is going to get off. This policeman is going to get off. It is because it's the way it has always operated in America. And so, you know, as you watch it and you hear it and you hear the lies and attempted lies and the rest of it, it's really speaks so badly of the way in which people have been murdered and taken advantage of in this country.
Vera?
I mean, I would say it weighs very heavily on many of us watching aspects of the trial. I find it incredibly difficult to listen and to hear some of those efforts to blame the victim of this brutal murder by a police officer. To me, it is a reminder of how tactics in the courtroom to smear the victim of a crime committed by a particular member of the police department may work in this country. I think I talk with African American colleagues and friends about it, and there is a lot of tension in them in terms of what they fear might be the outcome. And I'm still optimistic and hopeful that there will be a conviction, but that is clearly not an overwhelming sense in the African American community.
Angie.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a travesty, I think, and but sadly, it's not new. You know, if we look at all the other cases of police brutality, the same thing over and over again, right, that they try to smear the victim. And, you know, I'd like to point out, too, in this country, you cannot be murdered for taking drugs, okay? I mean, if you pose a clear threat, that's one thing. But,
yes.
You know, regardless, we're in a country where you are granted a trial, you have rights, you have Miranda rights, and things that you need to go through before you can be declared guilty. And even then, you're not necessarily murdered, right? So it just stuns me. You know, when I first read this article, I did wonder, you know, maybe the officer, you know, just had no sense of, you know, if what he was doing was fatal or whatnot. But I read his background. He's been on the force for 19 years. He's had 866 hours of paid training. And to say that he did this by accident is just does not make any sense to me. And there were other officers on top of him and two others at the scene. You know, I think this is just another, you know, incident that sadly may unfortunately go towards injustice, right? This is just not, I just cannot comprehend how the community feels about this.
You know, Joe, why this is such an important trial is because it's not only the facts in this trial and what happens, although that's very important. It is all about whether we're in a transitional period now in which we have decided as a nation that this has got to stop. In New York State, you have the governor asking every town and police department to come up with a plan basically to reform the way in which our police work. So I just want to make the point that it's not only the question of whether he's found guilty, although I think that's very important, Chauvin. But it's also the point at which are we at a place in America where we're about to make a U-turn, or at least a right turn or a left turn?
Vera?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what else to add to this conversation except to say that we are at a point where we will have to make a decision. Are we reforming police departments? Are we addressing fundamental systemic racism within the structure? Are we demanding changes in training and then consequences to failure to integrate and accept such training? Or are we accepting the status quo? And this is what this trial is symbolic of. What direction will this country take? And I think the interesting part is the world is watching. We, of course, all here in the United States are watching, but the world is watching.
Ira?
Yeah, I was going to echo a point that was made earlier, I think, by Angie. I don't care whether this guy had 14 pounds of heroin in his pocket. You don't get the death sentence for that, unless, of course, you use all that heroin. But seriously, there is no excuse for there to have had that been that 9.5 minutes of the pressure on this man's ability to breathe. You have four big, strong cops there. I know that Floyd was a big man, but there was no reason, in my view, from viewing those the famous digital tapes, that this guy could not have been subdued without having done it the way they did it. Now, I'm a little bit more optimistic about a conviction, although I don't think he will be convicted of murder. I think probably manslaughter. And I asterisk this point of view by saying that I have not watched a second of the trial. I've watched assiduously the summaries on the nightly news and in the New York Times to draw my conclusions and to learn what's happened. But it all comes back to me to that 9.5 minutes, and there was no way you can excuse that, particularly when he was not a threat to the policeman and the policemen.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and have our last call with the panelists this morning: Alan Chartok, Angie Chung, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Ira Fussfeld, all making up the group this morning. We do welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We'll get to some more of those on the other side. First, we have a break, and then we will have some news from the BBC from London, and then we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us, Alan Chartok, Angie Chung, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Ira Fussfeld, all making up our panel, and we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. In our remaining segment, I want to get to a couple of other stories, one being the fallout after the Capitol riot. This is from the New York Times. And they're calling this an uneasy detente that has emerged between congressional Republicans and Democrats. When a Republican lawmaker approached a representative, a Democrat on the House floor recently, with a routine request that she sign on to a resolution he was introducing, she initially refused. Veronica Escobar personally liked the man, a fellow Texan, and she supported the bill, but she held the Republican who had voted to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election just hours after rioters stormed the Capitol partly responsible for the deadly attack and questioned whether she should work with him. Moments after declining, however, Ms. Escobar had second thoughts. So, in the immediate aftermath of the assault on the Capitol that left five dead, irate Democrats vowed to punish Republicans for their roles in perpetuating or indulging President Donald Trump's fiction of a stolen election that motivated the mob that attacked the building. There was talk of cutting off certain Republicans entirely from the legislative process, denying them the basic courtesies and customs that allow the House to function even in polarized times. What has unfolded instead has been something of an uneasy detente on Capitol Hill as Democrats reckon with what they experienced that day and struggle to determine whether they can salvage their relationship with the Republicans, some of whom continue to cast doubt on the legitimacy of President Trump's victory and whether President Biden's victory, and whether they even want to try. What an odd situation, Alan.
Well, let's face it. Trump was a Hitlerian figure. I've said it 1,000 times. I'm going to say it again. Hundreds of thousands of people died because of this guy. And yet the Republicans steadfastly stand where they stand and will refuse to criticize or to critique. So we have a story here. Your story was interesting in that, and I read it, you know, in my usual time in the middle of the night, in which the Democrat reaches across the aisle and says, "Well, I was wrong. I want to be nicer to the Republican," and there doesn't seem to be any give back on that from the Republicans to the Democrats. So the idea of an uneasy détente leaves me baffled. Détente in that the Democrats are sort of eating this, but that's I don't understand where this becomes even-handed at all.
Especially as the article indicates, there are still so many that are questioning the legitimacy of the election, which is, you know, still based on the big lie. Right. Ira, your thoughts.
Yeah, you know, we've all seen video of legislatures from around the world with occasionally coming to fisticuffs and having a large scrum and people beating on each other on the floor of their legislative chambers, and we laugh at it, and we say this could never happen here. Well, I'm here to tell you we're about 2 steps from that happening here. There's going to come a day where Louis Gohmert or somebody is going to say something that's so ridiculous that a hot-headed Democrat's going to walk over and hit him on the head with a shoe. I mean, the level of discourse in this country has gotten to a point where, and we were discussing this a little bit on the Media Project earlier today, that I wish I was smart enough to have the answer, but I know a big part of it is the Fox News, is the late Rush Limbaughs, and now I guess Mark Levin and Sean Hannity, etc. As long as they continue to stoke up the flames, and as long as the people who they're talking to are not listening to the other side, we're moving closer and closer to this. And you know, Alan, you're right that the Democrats sort of have it ingrained that to have a détente, even though that they didn't do. The other side is the one that should be coming hat in hand to them, but it's just the atmosphere in this country and in the media environment is just is not allowing it to occur.
Vera?
Yeah, I mean, I would say from, you know, reading this article and thinking about the personal element of having to interact or the expectation to have to interact with people across the aisle who express such virulent anger and rejection of particular ideas would make me stop from, you know, would make me very nervous about collaborating. I certainly understand if you are coming from a very liberal, democratic, progressive state that sort of collaboration could be extremely challenging personally and also politically. So I'm not surprised that there's real reluctance to on the side of the Democrats to cooperate on with certain people. I mean, this is just the repercussion of conduct by some representatives.
Angie?
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with the other panelists. I mean, hats off to these public officials, what they must be grappling with between just knowing that their fellow politicians were partly the reason why that, you know, awful travesty happened at the Capitol, and then having to find a way to be bipartisan on some of these issues, right? But, you know, again, you got to look at it from the other perspective. If, you know, Republicans had met them halfway, these ones who are denying the election results, and, you know, apologized or something, you know, like had made some type of gesture, then maybe we wouldn't be in this situation. But I honestly don't know how they could work in this type of environment. It's really difficult. It's a difficult issue.
I flipped on Hannity the other night, and the Chiron on the screen was talking about Biden's lies. And you have to almost admire the chutzpah of somebody like Hannity, who never used the word lie in relationship to Trump, the demonstrably the biggest lying president in the history of this country. And here he's using the word lie to describe Joe Biden. And that's the kind of rhetoric that people on the far right and the right-leaning moderates are hearing without getting a more measured view of what's going on from other media, because they're just simply not watching it. I mean, it's torture, but if you are on the left or a moderate and have never watched Hannity or other programs on Fox, you ought to do it just to get a sense of how bad it is. It's just unbelievable what's going on over there.
If you want to see if your head could actually explode off your shoulders, you ought to give it a shot.
Yeah.
Angie?
Yeah, no, I actually did an article recently. We had studied the newspaper media, conservative and liberal, in the United States with South Korean liberal and conservative media. And it was based on their coverage of the pandemic. But it was just shocking, like, you know, that we call some of what's been, you know, posted in Fox News as investigative journalism. To me, it sounded like political propaganda. Like, it was just shocking to see some of the quotes and the things that were said. You know, I think I agree with Ira. We're at this cusp where something's got to give. I really do think the root of all these problems that we're talking about today really comes from this political standstill, and that, you know, that we've now started to compromise our constitutional commitment and notion of civil rights and humanity in favor of partisanship, you know? And I think that something's got to give.
Alan, Ira was just talking about the torture of watching the Hannity program, but I'm just curious of the fact that Biden is getting such high marks and is... I think we all realize this is, you know, perhaps fleeting, but as of at the moment right now, he has record high approval ratings and is getting high marks. And yes, even from Republicans, that must just really torture that narrative.
Well, and one has to wonder why that is happening. I think the American people are coming to their senses and saying it's so good to have a moderate, decent man there, as opposed to or woman who is able to make us feel better about ourselves, rather than that indescribable what's a good word, rat, who tried to I'm arguing against myself here, trying to do everything in his power to decide to divide the American people. I think that's what. And I'm not so sure, you know, we're all saying, okay, sooner or later it's going to turn on Biden. But I don't know. You know, I think one of the reasons that Trump is shutting up right now, and he is shutting up relatively, is because he knows that if he opens his yap, he's going to remind people why they elected Biden president.
We just have about 3 minutes left, and I want to end with this story, which is about the coronavirus and what we know now. We've been talking about it a little bit this week, but this from the CDC, which came out yesterday, this highly infectious variant of the coronavirus that was first identified in Britain has become the most common source of new infections in the United States. That according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The worrisome development comes as officials and scientists warn of a possible fourth surge of infections. Federal health officials said in January that the B.1.1.7 variant, which began surging in Britain in December and has since slammed Europe, could become the dominant source of coronavirus infections in the United States, leading to a huge increase in cases and deaths. At that point, new cases, hospitalizations, and deaths were all at an all-time high. From that peak, the numbers all declined until late February. After several weeks at a plateau, new cases and hospitalizations are increasing. The average number of new cases in this country has reached nearly 65,000 a day as of Tuesday, concentrated mostly in metro areas in Michigan as well as in New York City. That is a 19% increase compared with the figure 2 weeks ago. I think I read out of those cases that it's Michigan, Pennsylvania, and New York that make up a majority of those cases. Rochelle Walensky, the CDC director, who warned last week that she felt a recurring sense of impending doom, said on Wednesday that 52 of the agency's 64 jurisdictions, which include states, some major cities and territories, are now reporting cases of the so-called variants of concern, including B.1.1.7. So what we are to make of that, Alan?
People are stupid.
That's what we make of that.
There are people who don't want to take this vaccine. It almost ties into the last story. It depends on which quote-unquote experts they're listening to, and that doesn't even take into account the evangelicals who have religious reasons, supposedly, for not taking the vaccine. And it's hurting the rest of the country in addition to exposing themselves. It's infuriating, and it's baffling, and welcome to the United States 2021.
But, well, Ira, I don't know. I said that in three words.
Yeah, you did. Well, I'm in a hurry because Tiger Woods is waiting for me to go to Andrew Giuliani.
Yeah. Al, that was a good Cliff Notes version. Vera, and we say, as Ira just said, you know, this is the United States 2021, but goodness, this is an issue going around the world. This is a global issue, and we've seen this, as we've just noted, it's a British variant, and yet it is just ravaging Europe. It is ravaging the rest of the globe. And we are maybe a couple steps behind, but we're looking over our shoulder and seeing what's coming. And we have about a minute. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at what's happening in Europe and the third wave and shutdowns, you know exactly what's coming unless we have an incredible continuation and increase of our vaccination rates. Right. The only thing that distinguishes us from continental Europe is the vaccination rate. And that has given us a sense of protection. But if we don't increase that and if we don't convince certain communities to participate, then those states and those communities will suffer tremendously because there's no way to stop it.
To say nothing about wearing masks. I mean, you're right about the vaccination. Certainly that is incredibly important. But still, you still see all these pictures of these foolish people walking around without masks. You know, I have a very close relative, namely my wife, who went down to New York and came back and reported everybody was wearing a mask. I don't think so.
I'm going to let Tim have the last word, who channels Alan and says, stupid will never acquiesce because stupid is too stupid to know they are stupid, and they will always believe they are right.
That's so true.
We will end there this morning. My thanks, Alan, of course, as always. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Angie, Vera, Ira, a delight to have you all here. Thank you very much for your participation. We'll be back right after this.